Welcome to Across the Margin, the podcast. I'm your host, Michael Shields. Across the Margin, the podcast is a proud member of the Osiris Media Group. Head over to osirispod.com. Check out all their podcasts, all their live events, everything they got going on. That is osirispod.com. In this episode of Across the Margin, the podcast, I present an interview with the author of the 33rd and a third book dedicated to legendary Britpop band Pulp's renowned album, This Is Hardcore, that is Jane Savage. As co-founder and co-head of legendary PR company Savage & Best, Jane Savage is widely credited as being one of the main instigators of the Britpop movement that swept the UK in the mid-1990s. During this time, Savage & Best represented Suede, Pulp, The Verve, Elastica, and Long Pigs, whilst representing many of the other artists of the era, including The Cranberries, The Fall, and Jesus and Mary Chain. Besides being the author of this excellent 33rd and a third book, she is the author of Lunch with the Wild Frontiers and Here They Come with Their Makeup On, Suede, Coming Up, and More Adventures Beyond the Wild Frontiers. As Jane's book spells out, This Is Hardcore is Pulp's cry for help. A giant, sprawling, flawed masterpiece of a record, the 1998 album manages to tackle some of the most inappropriate grown-up issues of the day: fame, aging, mortality, drugs, and pornography, and still come out crying and laughing on the other side. The subject of pornography dominates the record, from its controversial artwork to the images conjured up by songs like Seductive Berry, as well as the title track. Pulp's lead singer and guitarist, Jarvis Cocker, spent most of his teenage and adult life chasing celebrity, only to be cruelly disappointed when it finally arrived in spades, and thus set forth on This Is Hardcore to use pornography as a metaphor for fame. The album's commercial failure as a follow-up to the band's Britpop-defining Different Class also symbolizes a death knell for Britpop itself. Dark, right? Except, just like Pulp themselves, Jane Savage's book is playful and sometimes very funny, kicking off with an imaginary conversation between Jarvis Cocker and the people who run the Total Fame Solutions helpline. Jane expertly guides us through the trials and tribulations of an album that begins with the so-called Michael Jackson incident, when Cocker got up on stage at the 1996 Brit Awards and waggled his fully clothed bum at the King of Pop. Pulp's This Is Hardcore may be a sleazy run through porn and mental demise, in an album that chronicles Cocker's continuing disillusionment with his newfound lot in life. But Jane's book assesses the cultural and historical context of the album with insider knowledge and a sharp modern lens, making a case for it as one of the most important albums of the 1990s, which I couldn't agree with more. In this episode, Jane and I dig into the weighty themes present in This Is Hardcore, revolving around fame, aging, success, and pornography. We expound upon the Michael Jackson incident, which propelled lead singer Jarvis Cocker to unfathomable fame. We discuss how Jarvis used music and the crafting of This Is Hardcore as catharsis for his real-life struggles, and talk about what the ultimate legacy of Pulp might be while celebrating a 33rd and a third book that serves as a love letter to a remarkable album. Grab a copy of Jane Savage's This Is Hardcore 33 and a third book. It's fantastic. You're going to learn more about that book and this incredible album in this interview with Jane Savage.
Podcast.
Good. Thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it.
No problem. It's nice to be here.
Great. I love the book. It's fantastic. I learned so much about an album I really, really love. So glad to talk about it. I'm curious to get us going. What was it like kind of writing this book and revisiting, a period of time in Pulp's career that is so notable and, such a special album, considering your involvement and your passion for the album and the band?
Okay, so this 33 and a third book is the third book I've written.
Yep.
And I think I've always wanted to write a 33 and a third book. And I think I would have chosen Murmur by REM, but it's already been done. So I wanted to do a record that I think I knew a lot about.
Uh-huh.
Could have done Different Class, but it's kind of obvious. It's got all the hits.
Yeah.
This Is Hardcore is a very deeply resonant record. And I think it's a record that keeps on giving, you know, when you're writing about it, because there's so many metaphors that are going on. And obviously it was written at a very difficult point in Pulp's career. So I kind of, when I sort of approach writing a book, I always go, why am I writing this book? What is the year zero for this book? What is the inciting incident, as it were? And it came down to the incident at the Brit Awards when Michael Jackson, when Jarvis got on stage and waggled his fully clothed bum, I'd say, Michael Jackson, October the 19th, 1996. And that kind of sent Jarvis's fame into orbit. And if you think about Pulp and Jarvis, you know that by that point they've been going for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd received some kind of fame because they'd had two number two hits by that point and they'd headlined Glastonbury. But it, and that was kind of a fame on their own terms, you know, after all that time. Jarvis was slightly older, or the band was slightly older than your normal breakthrough band who were in their 20s. And I think that particular incident made Jarvis the fifth most famous man in Britain, I think it was, one paper said, behind John Major, who was the Prime Minister, Frank Bruno, who was a boxer, Will Carling, who was having an affair with Princess Diana at the time, and Michael Barrymore, who was a TV presenter. And so to be in that orbit, he basically used to walk down the street, expect, when he saw policemen, expect to be arrested. Instead, they'd want his autograph. So I think this was very unusual for him, because he'd always wanted to be a famous, like an astronaut, so he could get the girls, as it were. And this meant he was become famous for doing the wrong kind of thing. And that sent him a bit, made him have a bit of a breakdown. So he ran away to New York and halfway through a recording session, actually, for the next
record. Really? Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So they went into the studio at the end of that year and recorded Help the Aged, which is about old people, obviously, and a song called Cocaine Socialism. And Jarvis started having second thoughts about the writing process halfway through recording that song, ran away to the Paramount Hotel in New York, checked himself in under a fake name, and got disturbed by a member of the Labour Party who rang him up and said, can we count on your support in the forthcoming election? So even there, they tracked him down. So there's a whole fascinating backstory to this record that made it ripe for writing about.
Yeah, it's wild how you know, it did make him paranoid. Was he wearing bulletproof vest at one point? And just kind of the fallout from that event was pretty intense.
Yeah, I think when they were touring the States in the middle of 96, all the headlines in the New York Times, etc., were man who waved his bum at Jacko in town, that kind of thing. And I think I'm not sure if he wore a bulletproof vest.
Or he was contemplating it, maybe.
Yeah, he was contemplating it, yeah. Yep. So I think all that, and then that level of fame became so intense for him, he started coming up with this metaphor that it's rather like, I mean, this might be an excuse to watch lots of pornography. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I was going to take this to that porn metaphor, because, I mean, he talks about how, you know, it is about fame and it is about success, what they're talking about, but he says the starting point, is porn. So what are the parallels there? What is he saying with that metaphor?
I think he said that on the tour bus, they used to watch all these films and they'd see them and maybe 6 months later or another film that the person had made many months later, and you'd see the washed out look in their eyes, the way they'd been used and spat out by the industry. And it felt to him, that's what he felt about himself. So he started to create this metaphor that hardcore pornography was very similar to the scrutiny you get from being famous, which is when they decided to employ Peter Saville to come up with a design for the cover, which is kind of a pornographic cover. The woman on all fours, you can't tell. She looks like she's been flung down there. Yep. And I, that was the artwork that I had to go on radio to defend at the time. Mm. And of course, I defended it because I was defending Pulp and sort of kicked the argument into the long grass by saying, Pulp would never do anything like that, etc. And then, of course, the intervening years have made me really contemplate that cover, how actually the digital manipulation of the image takes it away from being a painting by John Curran and towards a photograph, which is very different. And the way the words This is hardcore, is printed across her neck. Makes it looks like it's been stamped on her, like she's owned. And then I came up with the idea that it's rather, we don't know anything about the model. She's called Ksenia, by the way, and she's from Belarus. We don't know anything about her in the same way that we don't know anything about Lolita. We just hear Humbert, talking about Lolita. We never hear her thoughts and feelings on anything. And that kind of nameless, anonymity is kind of exploitative, really. So I think all those reasons made me not come down in favor of the artwork, whilst acknowledging that it's a beautiful image and it does what Jarvis wanted it to do. And then I came on the other side saying, a snuff movie about a snuff movie is still a snuff movie.
I have that line written right here. It really sums it up. Yeah. It sums it up perfectly. And it's I mean, but it does do what he was looking for. It draws you in and kind of makes you think and does allude to that porn metaphor. One thing that kept coming up from all over the place throughout all the songs you were writing about was kind of this idea of music as catharsis. You d described it perfectly as the album as DIY therapy. And he was writing music and crafting the album as a way to face his fears. Can you talk about that some? Because that kept coming up a whole bunch.
Yeah, it's almost like that he's on the couch and we're listening to him to what to his deepest, darkest thoughts. And obviously the fear is really, which is about panic attacks. And and that's why one of the, I mean, one of the when, rather than just describe every song in detail, which I actually do, and I
Yeah, you
love doing
do.
that, and I've been doing that for a long time because I've written, hundreds of biographies of bands. And this is just an excuse to really, let your hair down, as it were. I think what the chapters I really enjoy writing are those ones which take a leap of imagination, or if I was going to possibly some kind of magically realist sort of stance where, so for instance, one I go into the record, I go into HMV to try and return the record to the shop assistant because I've been given the wrong record. It doesn't sound like pulp. The cover's very, very difficult. Could not possibly be a pulp record. And he shows it to me and says, well, it says Island Records. It says this is hardcore. And then he starts playing it in the shop. And the whole shop is transformed into this horror, landscape. And then, of course, as I'm listening to it, I realize, look, hang on. I think they've done some interviews talking about what a horrible record it is. And so I asked to have my record back. And I love writing about the conversations that the shop assistant has had with Mariah Carey fans and Celine Dion fans and Madonna fans, because you never get any trouble with those people. You only get trouble with pulp fans. And I love writing chapters like that because they're not your normal run-of-the-mill chapter. But to answer your question, I think, yes, Jarvis treated us as a sounding board for his nightmares and was just getting them all off his chest, as it were. But he also had a Jarvis and Steve have a background in film, going to film school. And so I think they flex their muscles with that a bit. And they obviously commissioned Ireland to spend £250,000 on the video for This Is Hardcore, which is still my favourite video ever made, which is, it's a film basically with eight or nine key scenes that change the drama as you go through. And that's Jarvis and Steve really showing that they know their stuff about movies, I think.
Just taking a second to kind of tip my hat to read a bunch of these 33 and a third books. Love the series, and I've never read a prelude that I've appreciated more or a postlude than yours. It was fantastic how you framed the book with that whole total fame solutions idea.
So don't, I won't be giving the ending of the book away too much if I say, well, okay, first of all, at the start
So
of
good.
the, I was halfway through writing the book and I suddenly thought, this book is about fame. What do I think about fame? Why do we all want to be famous as children? And Jarvis, his dad had left the home when he was 7 years old and gone away to Australia. In fact, I think Jarvis said there was a point when, in 1 month in 1970, when all the dads all left home, went somewhere. Maybe that was just a thing that dads did or whatever, but they obviously left women to cope with bringing up children alone. And so Jarvis was brought up in a household of women. In fact, his mum said, oh, he said that his mum pulled him out to shave, which was very strange because she never shaved herself. But so at the beginning of the book, I thought, okay, well, let's frame this, try and work out what fame means. So I thought, what if Jarvis calls a helpline called Total Fame Solutions to see if they can help him because he's become famous by mistake. And they come back, they put him through to the philosophy department and the resolutions department where they throw little names at him like Hegel and Nietzsche. and self-consciousness attains its self-consciousness in another self-consciousness. And the fact that when we become famous first, we become famous for our parents. They're our audience.
I
And
love
when
that. I love that parallel there, or that idea. It's
yeah.
absolutely true. Yeah.
And when one parent dies, or when both your parents die, you lose this audience, and you hanker after something else. And I think, and I read a lot of academic studies about fame, and in fact pulp as well. And rather than just, and I wrote to one of the guys who wrote this article about fame and audiences and why we become famous, an American scholar called Jed Lee Henry, and I thanked him at the end of the book because he'd set me off on this train of thought. And it is very true, I think, when you think about it, that we do dance in front of our parents and they love us unconditionally. And when that goes, we suddenly want to, become an astronaut, possibly become famous. And of course, maybe that's where it comes from, this constantly wanting to entertain someone, which starts off with our parents and ends up being the audience of the world. And of course, at the end of the book, I won't say how it ends, except that they call him back.
No, it's really wonderful the way it's bookended like that. Just kind of piggyback off what you're saying. It's interesting how growing up in just a home full of women, and with his father leaving, it did contribute to his worldview, and also then leaked into his music and the way he was writing songs. A lot of his songs are from women's perspectives. Kind of daddy issues is explored a little bit in A Little Soul. Can you talk about how it did kind of shape the way he would write songs, and kind of especially from perspective, speaking of perspective.
Okay, so A Little Soul is Jarvis's dad singing a song to his son, saying, "Please don't, you might look like me, but please don't end up like me," which I think, which is extraordinary thought, really. And obviously, the video, if you've ever
Okay.
seen, features lots of mini me's. Every single member of the band has a mini me who are forcibly pushing their maxi me's onto their drum stool, their guitar, bass, their keyboards, etc. And so that's, you can see what Jarvis is doing there. But generally, in his in the way he writes, I think This Is Harker was his first grown-up album. Before, I think Jarvis writes about women. I think I write. I suggest he casts himself as savior as women in lots of roles. So the boyfriend will be shit, so he steps in and saves the day. The woman's dad will be shit, so he'll step in and save the day. And so it's always this Jarvis figure is looming along, within the narrative. But then look, sometimes you never know which is the real Jarvis, because there'll be seven different perspectives that Jarvis will have throughout the song. So he's a very, very clever lyricist. In fact, I've got an even more respect for his lyrics after listening to the album and examining the lyrics 50 times in the space of several months. And he's done lectures about the process of writing lyrics, and says actually you shouldn't read the lyrics whilst you listen to the record, which I obviously did, and I didn't take that on board. So yeah, I think there's, I mean, obviously there are different characters that he inhabits within the songs. He's a very clever writer.
Absolutely. Yeah, like you were saying, I love the when he was talking about kind of lyrics versus poetry, because I think about that a lot. And I've always kind of considered, lyrics poetry, but I kind of like the way he delineated and how he thought they should be written in prose and the whole thing. But it's interesting to read kind of what you were just talking about too, is backlash to male toxicity and lad culture, and how he was talking about wishing there was an alternative to manhood. I thought that was really interesting stuff. I'd love to talk a bit, or just kind of give some love to some of the other contributors to the album that make it so great. I'm talking about Steve's incredible bass lines, and Dudley's strings, Nicholas's Dodd's orchestrations. A lot of people brought some magic to make this album so special.
Yeah, the orchestration is so beautiful, isn't it? I mean, particularly on This Is Hardcore itself.
Oh yeah, and that guitar solo on that. Oof.
So, and obviously, I mean, I think Party Hard is Mark's greatest guitar piece, I think. Everybody compares that song to David Bowie, but they're never particularly specific about what Bowie period they mean, which is why when I try to rip that song apart, I said it's actually more like Iggy Pop's Blah Blah Blah, and which is actually possibly some outtakes from Bowie's Tonight, and was produced by Bowie, and Iggy disowned, saying that it's a Bowie name album in name only. So there's a fine, some of the guitar on that is like Steve Jones, as obviously, which I think Mark sort of apes the Steve Jones sound on that. And then of course So, and Steve Mackey brought lots of new sounds as well, lots of electronic sounds. So it's there's a lot of it that's not your traditional pulp record. I mean, I think on things like Feeling Called Love and My Legendary Girlfriend were the two pointers for this is hardcore going way back, with that quiet loud thing and the gaps when you can't, you don't quite know what to do with yourself. And I think they surface on This Is Hardcore more than on any other record, those kind of sensibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to bring up one more song, one I really love, and you start off the chapter about it and saying, why is the day after the revolution the most joyous, perfectly realized song on This Is Hardcore? I'd love to hear you talk about why, because it's special.
Okay, well, I'll try and remember what I said in that chapter now, but I think I probably said the reason was because it's taken us so long to get here. It's taken Pulp 20 years to get here, from 1978 when they formed at school as a two-piece to 1998 when this record is released. And the end of the revolution is obviously, there's so many things going on in that song. I mean, there's a 10-minute gap at the end with like a one just one repetitive silent noise, the silent noise, that doesn't make sense. One note resonates in the last 10 minutes of the song. And it's when Jarvis says at the end, it's the end of irony. And I think it was Jarvis saying, they're always accused of being ironic, Pulp or his lyrics. And we're coming to the end of the century. It's the end of everything. And it's the end of, they've reached the end of where they wanted to be. It's taken them so long to get there. That's why it's so perfectly realized. And it's got the sounds of Bowie's Berlin Trilogy on there, which is, my favorite era of Bowie records. And it's got that Lamont Young infused sound, and so I think, yeah, so it's a perfect end to a record. And I think I obviously could say, what are the best tracks that end
Love
records?
that paragraph. It's so
Yeah.
fun.
And Day in the Life and various Radiohead tracks
Yeah,
and various Voyager.
Taurus Smoke, Yeah, Computer. I think you do end up saying, which is makes sense. Day in the Life is right up there towards the top, which makes it. It's also the end of kind of the Britpop era, which is a big thing. So there was a lot of things concluding and a lot of change. It was a new era happening.
When you write a book, you're always told by your publisher to write down the three most important points about your book. That's what they want you to do everything for them. And of course, it was 20 different things I could have said, but the one that resonated with everybody in the press over here was that the record signified the end of Britpop, because I think Suede had tried to disassociate themselves in 94 by writing Dog Man Star, which is psychotic and deep and dark and sexual and not lost all Britpoppy, and Radiohead were trying to do it, and Blur had done re the record that made them go all American. But I think the reason that this record did it, I mean, some people say it was the death of Princess Diana, for instance, a year earlier that did it. Or then John Harris said in his book, it was England getting knocked out of the Euros in 1996. But there's all these theories, but I think this record was intended for Pulp to throw away everything they made before this. I don't know whether there's a program that ever reached the States called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, but in that series, he creates these grot shops, which are useless objects, and he wants to end his career. But unfortunately, they take off, and everybody starts buying these useless objects, and he becomes a multimillionaire. And I think Jarvis was trying to do the same thing, to disassociate himself with the past. And for the things that he just because he'd end up in the wrong place. So they recorded dark songs, made a very difficult record with a very difficult cover to contemplate. And it ended Britpop because it wasn't 10 Common Peoples anymore. It was something else entirely. So I think that's what was going on in that record. It ended Britpop.
Yep, absolutely. So what would you say to bring us home here? What would you think after diving back into the album deeply and contemplating it and just, kind of experiencing it your whole life? What would you think the legacy of, I would say Pulp or Jarvis, but I guess to be more pointed, what the legacy of This Is Hardcore is, now that in contemplation looking back?
Okay, so after This Is Hardcore, they only recorded one more album, We Love Life, 3 years later. And then they took a long hiatus. So obviously they reformed and then took another long hiatus, and they reformed again 18 months ago. And now they play festivals and they're writing the odd new song again. Who knows whether 10 common peoples would have sent them into a different kind of orbit altogether. If they'd recorded different class two, what would have happened? When I look back now, I'm so glad they recorded This Is Hardcore, because it's a record that bears constant, listening. And there's so many themes that needed to be written. And it was probably only Pulp that were going to do it. No other band at that time, with the exception of Suede, possibly. Well, even then, Suede had started to become a bit more laddie. We were written about toxic masculinity in the way of like I'm the Man, or the track on the record, because at that time it was an era of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, all the Guy Ritchie movies. It was the era of Loaded. It was the era of GQ just patronizing men with the way they should treat women. And it was Liam Gallagher saying nasty things to Justine from Elastica about not wanting that he wouldn't kick her out of bed. All those things Jarvis wrote about on This Is Hardcore. And I think people thought he was gay, because he wasn't
They're
because he
not
wasn't
into that, yeah.
the kind of man that they were used to dealing with. And I really admire Jarvis for sticking to his guns for those things.
Yeah. No, I liked, when he was pushing back and kind of wishing there was an alternative to manhood. I mean, he was showing that alternative to that type of manhood, which is super, super toxic. I love the idea that the message of This Is Hardcore, I think it was his words, is to be careful what you hanker after. It may come true, and it won't be quite what you expected. And that kind of, it's that's kind of like the takeaway in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, it's a Yorkshire version of Oscar Wilde, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, be careful what you wish for. Well, I think didn't Oscar Wilde say there's only one thing that's worse than being talked about, and that's not being talked about, which is obviously his way of saying it. But I think, be careful what you hanker after. You might just get it. Is this in a similar kind of bracket, I think.
Absolutely. I've always loved this album. It's got these just it's so theatric, the triumphant thing. But after reading your book, I even felt more in love with it, just kind of digging into the lyrics, doing what Jarvis said not to do, listen to music with the lyrics. But I learned so much about an album that means so much to me. So that's it's a thank you for the book. Thank you for your time talking about it. It's great. Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad that it's gone, that the book is written well enough that someone who loves the album even more after reading the book. That's surely the goal of writing it.
Totally. That's certainly the case. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it, Jane.
Thank you, Michael.
This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.